Hello, and welcome to Bible Talk, a show about the Bible, its history, and the people who believe in it. Today's episode is called Enoch Ascends to Heaven, because that's what today's episode is about. Last time we were looking at the book of Enoch to explore the Judaic origins of angels, demons, the fall of angels and that whole battle and all that stuff. And that's what we did. But last time we were talking about, you know, that Genesis chapter 6 and the story of Enoch, and it was kind of vague about how Enoch walked with God and then he was no more, but it doesn't say that he died, whereas all the other antediluvian patriarchs, the Bible is very clear on the fact that they died. So Enoch, I mentioned last time, shares the distinction that only two other people in biblical canon share, and that is Elijah and Jesus Christ, and that is they ascended to heaven without dying. Obviously, Jesus did die. That was kind of the whole point. But when he ascended to heaven, he ascended as, you know, his whole corporal form. He didn't ascend just as spirit. And the same thing can be said of Enoch, and the same thing can be said of Elijah. And it really is biblical canon, too. I know I said the book of Enoch is Apocrypha, yet the Bible, though it doesn't have all these details in it, the Bible still implies that Enoch didn't die and that he did in fact ascend to heaven. And the majority of Jewish traditions, at least, also reflect that belief. So Enoch actually ascended to heaven twice. It's kind of crazy. The first time, so last time I talked about how, you know, the Watchers, they thought that, you know, women were hot, so they wanted to come down, have sex with the women, they had children, the Nephilim, and God was like, you can't do that. So he got very mad at the Watchers, and he's like, hey, yo, listen, Watchers, you're never going to come back to heaven again. And the Watchers are like, no. See, up until this point, I guess they had been moving freely between the heaven and the earth, and God was like, no, you're not allowed up here. So the Watchers actually went to Enoch, and they go, Enoch, you know, we know you're tight with the Lord because you're a pious man. You have to go intercede on our behalf. And this process is actually a very striking resemblance to me anyway, to the current Catholic tradition of the intercession of saints. And that is the belief that, you know, you and I can pray, and our prayers may or may not be answered, but at least the New Testament teaches us that the prayers of the particularly righteous are particularly efficacious. And if you pray to a saint who is, you know, well known to be a righteous fellow or a righteous woman, I suppose, if you pray to that saint, your prayer is more likely to be answered. It's really no different here. It's just in this case, which is, you know, kind of strange for us to think about, you have angels begging for a righteous man to intercede on his behalf. Whereas usually in most traditions, it's the other way around. You have men praying to angels like, you know, oh, Michael or oh, Raphael or whoever. You know, that is a rare thing. Most people pray directly to the big man. But you know, most people, you can say the same thing about saints, but that isn't to say that, you know, Catholic people don't, you know, believe in the intercession of saints and pray to them as well. So it's a very similar process. So they basically bring Enoch in and they're like, hey, yo, Enoch, you need to, you know, go intercede on our behalf. And Enoch's like, so he's a scribe. So he takes down their plea. And then he gets whisked away. And first he sees all of the things in the earth. He sees Eden. He sees the stone pillars, which support the earth. He sees, you know, the things in the west, the things in the east, all sorts of crazy things he sees. I also beheld the four winds which bear up the earth and the firmament of heaven. It's crazy. The pillars of heaven, and he sees the path of the angels. I perceived at the extremity of the earth the firmament of heaven above it, and then I passed on towards the south. So he sees all these things, and then eventually, he finds himself in heaven. And this is very interesting, his account of heaven, because it's very unlike what the, you know, traditional, you know, when you think of Christian heaven, you're imagining angels flying around, playing harps and like the clouds and stuff. This version of heaven is a lot more similar to like the Greek underworld in that, so first of all, there's no distinction between heaven. Well, there is a small distinction between heaven and hell, but, and I guess geographically would be the wrong term to use, but at least not geographically, in that they're both above in heaven. So the first thing he sees is he sees the throne of God. And what's interesting to me about that is his descriptions of heaven sound to me a lot like hell. And part of that, I think, is, you know, this whole fear of God. Because God is a striking, imposing figure. And, you know, some legends say that you can't look upon God or, you know, it'll surely kill you. You know, things like that. So Enoch goes to this place and he describes it as being so terrifying, so dreadful that he couldn't wait to be out of it. So obviously this isn't biblical. It's in the Apocrypha, unless you're a member of, Beta Israel or one of the Coptic faiths. It's not biblical, but neither is heaven or hell, really. The New Testament describes, you know, some place of fire and brimstone and much weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's a bit of a tongue twister there. But the Book of Enoch is kind of the only real source of what heaven looks like, because that, you know, we see Enoch, you know, come to heaven and he examines the whole place. So he sees this place. He also sees, you know, a valley of, you know, of the righteous, and he sees the place where the watchers who rebelled, where they met up and they kind of conspired and they're like, we're going to have sex with women here. And, you know, they descend into heaven, they appointed their leaders there. And he also sees the place where the watchers were, you know, going to go to be punished. And all these places sound kind of like hell. And they're also super intense, like fiery lassos that are gripping stars, or like things that look like, at least his descriptions of stars are like, you know, big fiery orbs, which I guess are angels. It's like, it's a really crazy, it's just a crazy book. And, you know, they talk about the, it's also funny to me because he's taken around by different angels, mostly Michael, but also like Uriel and Raguel. And they like go and show him things. And Enoch is either like staring because they're, you know, they're fucking crazy things that he's seeing. He's seeing like angels just, you know, being imprisoned, or he's seeing, you know, the valley of horrible souls where the bad things are happening, and he sees the area of the elect. Christians would view it as like the area of the saved. Calvinists would love it. But he sees the area of the elect and the tree of the elect specifically. And Enoch does all these, and he always inquires about it, or, you know, exclaims about it. And this exchange happened, or some variant of it happens a lot in this book, and it's kind of funny. He says, I exclaimed, behold, this tree is goodly in aspect, pleasing in its leaf, and the sight of its fruit is delightful to the eye. Then Michael, one of the holy and glorious angels who were with me, and one who presided over them, said, Enoch, why dost thou inquire respecting the odor of this tree? They're always doing that. Enoch is staring at something like, Enoch, what are you looking at that for? And Enoch's like, geez, I mean, I'm just a human guy. Like, I've never seen this stuff before. So, you know, it's very interesting stuff. And that exchange happens a bunch of times. So, you know, Enoch meets with God and they have a one-on-one conversation. And that's when God kind of delivers his ruling to the watchers. He's like, okay, Enoch, tell the watchers they're fucked. I don't listen to their appeal. I'm coming for them, and I'm coming for them hard. And, you know, he does that whole thing where he rends the spirits from the Nephilim. In the Book of Jubilees, it's decided that it's another apocryphal book. We're actually going to talk about that, even though it takes place during the same time as Genesis. We're actually going to talk about that when we get to Exodus, because according to legend, it was written by Moses along with, or revealed to Moses when he was on top of Mount Sinai. So that's why we'll talk about it then. But basically in the Book of Jubilees, the spirits of the Nephilim, 1/10 of them are separated, and those are the demons that walk the earth today. But yeah, so he's, you know, he ascends to heaven, he sees all this stuff, and then he sees the blessed land, the lofty trees, that's the area of the elect, and this is hell, what we're about to learn about here, which, again, is in the same place as heaven. He's surveying both areas at once, and hell, I guess, is in between, because it says the accursed valley in between. Then Uriel, one of the holy angels who were with me, replied, this valley is the accursed of the accursed forever. Here shall be collected all who utter with their mouths unbecoming language against God and speak harsh things of his glory. Here they shall be collected. Here shall be their territory. So I want to talk about this verse as well, because this concept of heaven and hell is very mystic, very especially Kabbalistic, in that there, well, there's a story. It's called The Allegory of the Long Spoons, and I'll link it in this post. But basically, heaven and hell, for many traditions, are different places, but in a lot of traditions, they're one the same. It's just the types of people there are different. And the Allegory of the Long Spoons, and I forget who it is, but, you know, someone gets to tour heaven and hell. And so the first thing he does is he goes to heaven, and he sees all the heavenly things. And heaven is basically a really nice area, and it's, you know, a big plane, and there's a big dining table, and everyone has, you know, really long spoons that are chained to their hands, and the spoons are so long that they can't reach their mouths with the spoons. So what they do is they take their spoons and they feed the person across from them. So that way everyone has enough to eat and they can go frolic in the land and enjoy their things. I don't know why they can't eat with their hands, but they can't for some reason. There's something about the table, some force field, they can't do it. So then the guy goes to hell and he's shocked. He sees the same gate as before and he enters and it's the same field and he sees the table, but something's wrong. Everyone's starving and they're like, "Oh God, help us, we're all dying." And you know, he sees what's happening and he sees a bunch of people helplessly trying to feed themselves with these big ass spoons that'll never reach their mouths. And they're like dropping food everywhere. And the point is they can't eat. And the reason why I tell the story now is because for the majority of history, heaven and hell have been viewed as, you know, very related, especially in the Greek underworld, Elysium, the fields of Elysium, the Elysian fields. They're in the same place as the rest of the underworld. It's just a separate area where the heroes go. Similarly, the Babylonians believed everyone went to the same place, and of course it was the underworld. It was underground. And here we have the Jews, and they believed in something similar, except it was above, and everyone kind of went to the same place. And this is interesting to me, and I'm going to do a whole episode on this eventually. But atheists specifically, and, you know, a lot of Christians kind of doubt the cruelty of God. They're saying, oh, he's not merciful. He doesn't do all these things. And I posit to you that, or, you know, food for thought before we wrap up today's episode, that what this book is suggesting and what other beliefs suggest is that heaven and hell isn't about punishment. It's not about it almost sounds like it is here because, you know, it's talking about this is where the accursed go. But it's not about punishment. And bear with me for a moment. Rather than being about punishment, heaven and hell is a consequence. And consequence not in terms of as punishment, but as, you know, the thing that logically follows. In other words, you wouldn't blame God for being cruel if you walked off a cliff and you fell. And that's because one of the rules that happen is gravity. And you wouldn't say that gravity is particularly cruel, and you wouldn't say it's a good thing either, although you might. I mean, life would be pretty hard to live without gravity. But the point is, gravity isn't evil, even though a lot of people are dealt with cruelly with gravity. Now, another thing that you'll hear a lot when people say, hell is the absence of God. And so particularly from a Christian worldview, if you believe that God has to be invited into you, if you choose not to invite God into you, by definition, you've put yourself in hell. You're living with the absence of God. So, you know, I know a lot of atheists would say, well, I would feed the person across from me. And I'm not saying that this is a perfect explanation by any means. And I'm not saying I necessarily believe it either. I personally don't know what my views are on heaven and hell. What I am saying is it's something to consider here. Perhaps heaven and hell aren't punishment, but perhaps heaven and hell are what naturally follow when you live your life a certain way. It's just like, you know, you would expect if you worked hard to bear the fruits of that labor, and if you were to, you know, sit on your ass all day and, you know, get drunk, you might lose your house, you know, stuff like that. It's not particularly cruel. Although it's not great either, it's just the way things are. And yeah, that's just something to consider. Maybe heaven and hell, maybe they're not punishment. Maybe that's just the way things happen when you gather a bunch of people who don't believe in God together. Or who, you know, maybe it's not about believing in God, but maybe it's about, you know, just being a cruel person, especially if you're, I went to a Mennonite church once and it was very interesting. They take very literally the verse that God is love. And I met a lot of atheist people who actually attended that congregation, but the Mennonites would always tell them, well, you know, if you believe in love and you believe that love is the right thing to do, you believe in God because God is love. And, you know, you can imagine living a life without love. That sounds like hell to me. And that's not necessarily anyone punishing you. That's just the way things are. So, yeah, Enoch gets to see the heavens. And in doing so, he sees what we would at least regard as hell. And he comes back and he tells the Watchers, yeah, you're screwed. You're never going to get to go to heaven again. Although, you know, I did see some nice cells made up for you, basically. And the Watchers are like, no! So that was the first time Enoch ascended to heaven. The second time was permanently, and he became the Archangel Metatron. And we'll talk about him later when we start talking more about the Zohar and Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism. But yeah, he becomes the Angel Metatron. And that's the story of Enoch. So next time we're going to, you know, wrap up the Antediluvian period. We're going to start talking about Noah in the times afterwards. We'll talk about my favorite King Nimrod. He's not my favorite. Nebuchadnezzar's my favorite, but Nimrod's pretty cool. And thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you guys next time. Bye-bye.